ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, welcome to AM. It's Friday, the 5th of April. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. US President Joe Biden's issued a warning to the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the wake of a deadly strike on aid workers in Gaza that killed seven, including Australian Zomi Francom. In a phone call with the Israeli leader, President Biden suggested US policy toward Israel could change unless concrete steps were taken to protect aid workers and alleviate suffering. Barbara Miller is our North America correspondent. Barb, what more do we know about the demands made by Joe Biden on this call?
Well, a readout of the call between the two leaders says that Joe Biden made clear that US policy with respect to Gaza will be determined by an assessment of Israel's immediate action on steps. And the steps that we hear that Joe Biden asked Benjamin Netanyahu to announce and implement are to make it safer for aid workers in Gaza. Of course, this call happening soon after the deaths of seven aid workers, including an Australian, when their convoy was hit. So the US is asking Israel to make it safer for aid workers and to improve the humanitarian situation in Gaza to alleviate the harm and suffering by civilians. So this sounds like really quite a strong statement on behalf of the US. It appears to be a threat almost that US policy will change towards Israel. But then we've been getting that readout decoded by National Security Spokesman John Kirby, who is saying, well, no, the US, you know, its support of Israel is ironclad. We will not walk away. We support Israel's right to defend itself against a range of threats, including Hamas. But the way in which they are defending themselves against Hamas must change. Now, here's an example of an answer John Kirby gave when he was pressed again and again on what exactly might change if Israel doesn't take the steps the US is looking for.
It's not just about the announcement of concrete steps and changes in their policies, but it's the execution of those announcements and those decisions and implementing them. And so we obviously will watch closely and monitor how they do on the commitments that they make. And as I said earlier, if there's no changes to their policy and their approaches, then there's going to have to be changes to ours.
That's National Security Advisor John Kirby there. Barb, what are we hearing about the investigation into the strike on workers from World Central Kitchen?
Well, Israel's saying that it has completed the investigation. Now, that seems pretty quick. They're obviously under quite a bit of pressure to come up with an answer as to why this happened. They say that that investigation, the report, will be given to the Prime Minister and then will be made public. Now, World Central Kitchen is saying that's not enough. They are demanding an independent probe into the deaths of their workers. And they're calling on the governments of the impacted nations, including Australia, to support that call.
That's our North America correspondent, Barbara Miller. Australia is bringing home a spy plane that's helped protect the critical flow of humanitarian and military aid into Ukraine. The mission's been described as critical and successful, but still, the deployment hasn't been extended by our Western allies, the US and NATO, raising questions about support for the war. Europe correspondent Catherine Diss was at the Royal Air Force Base at Lossiemouth, Scotland, when the plane returned.
On a crisp, clear day, a crew of Australians have landed in northern Scotland to start their journey home to Newcastle. They've spent the past 6 months at America's Ramstein Air Base in Germany, monitoring the skies for threats to protect key logistic routes into Ukraine. Wing Commander Darren Lindsay helped run the mission's last rotation.
The assets and surveillance that were provided has always enabled the vital humanitarian aid, logistics supply feeding into Ukraine, and that's the success that we can measure.
The crew were deployed on the E-7 Wedgetail, a high-tech spy plane with powerful radar, able to simultaneously scan the land, air and sea. Brigadier Grant Mason heads up Australia's Defence Force in London. He says the main goal of the mission was maintaining a presence in the sky to deter Russian attacks.
It's demonstrating how partners will work together to ensure that vital activities like support and humanitarian assistance in situations like this are not interfered with by any third actor.
The deployment represents one of Australia's largest contributions to the war effort. It was sent on the request of the United States to fill a gap in capability no one else could offer. But since the call-up, there's been a big shift in priorities in the West, with global fatigue for the war settling in and America focused on its election at home. I spoke with Australia's High Commissioner to the United Kingdom, Stephen Smith, on the tarmac after the plane landed.
Does this indicate a scaling back in support for Ukraine if there's no one filling the gap?
Absolutely not, as the OCMIN meeting showed recently.
Is someone else filling it? Is the US military, is NATO?
Well, as I said earlier, we haven't been asked to make an ongoing contribution. We're not aware that anyone else has been asked to make a similar contribution.
Whether it represents a pullback in support from the West or a change in strategy, Ukrainian expert Orisa Lutsavich says Ukraine needs more aid, not less.
The United States is preoccupied with the elections. Europe itself is struggling to actually heat up its defense and military production. And this is a crunch time because Russians are able to mobilize much faster and they are actually preparing for a new push over the summit to take more Ukrainian territory.
In the United Kingdom, Australia's mission training Ukrainian soldiers for combat will continue. This is Catherine Diss in Lossiemouth, Scotland, reporting for AM.
8 years since the Northern Territory Royal Commission into Youth Detention recommended the Dondale Centre should close, Indigenous leaders are asking why major disturbances are still happening there. On Wednesday night, the NT police were forced to lock down the centre after a riot, fire damage to buildings and a rooftop protest. Jane Barden reports.
Police and fire trucks hurried into Darwin's Dondale Youth Detention Centre on Wednesday night as media crews filmed.
When we arrived, there were several detainees who were up on the roof. In fact,
one of the police officers called in to get the centre under control was injured in the leg with a projectile thrown from the roof, where young people stayed for hours through the night. Rioting kids also lit fires, damaging the centre's education and recreation blocks. Emma White is the head of the NT Government's Families Department.
This was a group of young people in detention, participating in education. A conflict's broken out between young people and it's escalated.
Tensions have been high in Dondale for 8 years after the ABC and Royal Commission revealed young detainees were being abused by staff. The NT Labour government promised to replace the centre with a more therapeutic one and fund more youth rehabilitation programmes. Instead, the Territory's Children's Commissioner says things are getting worse, with young people regularly locked in their cells most of the day because of staff shortages and worrying levels of self-harm. Darwin Indigenous community leader Josie Crawshaw was head of the NT's now defunded Aboriginal Child Protection Body.
We have lost all trust that the NT government will make any difference, even with their suggestion of opening a new jail, because the conditions continue to get worse. And the children are still being locked up 21 hours a day.
Emma White says on Wednesday there hadn't been a long lockdown before the riot and the centre had been fully staffed.
The principle we take to lockdowns is for the shortest time possible.
The NT Families Minister, Naria Kitt, says the government will complete a more appropriate new centre later this year.
There's been a number of reasons why the delay has occurred. We experienced more than 2 years with COVID implication. There was a shortage of steel, not just in the Northern Territory.
She says therapeutic programmes are being provided to young people in detention.
We have education and training opportunities. We have activities so that kids can run out their energy.
But community leader Josie Crawshaw says the government isn't funding enough support programmes in the community to stop young people going into detention.
They will not allow Aboriginal people and their communities, and they will not fund them to actually be part of that solution. You know, it's a real blight on this country that we cannot find the problems to solve that our children can grow up with hope and with a future.
That's Darwin Indigenous community leader Josie Crawshaw, ending that report by Jane Barden. Former Channel 7 producer Taylor Auerbach will be back in court today after presenting explosive evidence in the Bruce Lehrman defamation case yesterday. Mr. Auerbach told the court he was appointed Mr. Lehrman's babysitter and alleged the former Liberal staffer bought cocaine and searched the internet for sex workers. Mr. Lehrman launched his action against Network 10 after his trial over the alleged rape of Brittany Higgins was abandoned with no findings against him. Court reporter Elizabeth Byrne has been watching on and joined me a short time ago. Liz, these allegations of a wild night out with Bruce Lehrman, paid for by Channel 7, are certainly explosive, but just talk us through how they actually relate to his defamation case against Channel 10.
Well, of course, one of the key issues in the case with Channel 10 is the credibility of both parties, including Brittany Higgins and Bruce Lehrman. But the really key issue for Network 10 was to try and expose whether Bruce Lehrman was involved in handing over material that had been produced for the criminal trial but not used to the Spotlight program. Now, this matters because that could be an issue of contempt of court. Bruce Lehrman, of course, denies that he ever did this, and Channel 7 says they're not revealing any sources. So yesterday, Taylor Auerbach told the court that he obtained the material from Bruce Lehrman. So there was a lot of extraneous, interesting stuff discussed yesterday, but that is the nub of things. That's the thing that Network 10 was trying to draw out so that they can cast doubt on Mr. Lehrman's credibility.
So Taylor Auerbach will be back in court today. What can we expect from him?
Well, he might have had a bit of a busy evening because one of the things in this case has been whether messages about Bruce Lehrman, discussion about Bruce Lehrman, whether Network 7 issued an order to delete material. Now, Taylor Auerbach says that he thought that that's what was going on, so he did some deleting. 7 says that is absolutely not true, but they were unable to produce very much on the subpoenas when they were asked to produce it. And in fact, there's a bit of a problem with that because they were asked to do it some time ago before the trial, and then yesterday they did start to produce some things and the judges asked them why. It appears that it might be that they'd only searched 7 servers, and a lot of the information, like as you would do it as well, was on places like WhatsApp and Signal and personal emails to keep it as private as possible because it was a big story. So Taylor Auerbach's been going through his own records overnight, and today he can expect to be cross-examined by Bruce Lehrman's lawyer, Matthew Richardson, who's already put him through the ringer yesterday over some of these other claims.
Elizabeth Byrne. This time 2 years ago, Australia was facing an energy crisis with extreme price volatility brought on largely by a shortage of gas. As winter draws nearer, domestic gas supplies on the East Coast are still in short supply, especially in the southern states, but the government is claiming credit for a small gas surplus forecast for the months ahead. What will that mean for energy bills? Madeleine King is the Resources Minister, and we spoke earlier. Madeleine King, thanks for being with us. We've gone from a forecast shortfall of gas on the East Coast this winter to a small surplus of gas expected now. Will this go any way toward cheaper power bills?
Well, importantly, David, the ACCC's interim report onto the gas supply for the East Coast indicates that surplus will be available in the latter quarter three of 2024. And the 10 petajoule surplus is not that small. That's a significant amount of energy available into the system from the LNG producers in Queensland. The work that I've done in December of the year before last, 2022, reforming the Heads of Agreement, as well as reforming the ADGSM, combined with the Code of Conduct, together bring in more supply available to industry and to consumers. But more to your point, the Code of Conduct helps bring down the price available of gas to consumers. Having said that, we know there is still more work to do.
Yeah, there certainly is, because yes, it's 10 petajoules more than we expected, but the buffer is only 6 petajoules, so that's the sort of surplus, and we're talking about 500 odd petajoules that are expected to be used over winter. So we're talking about a 1% buffer. It wouldn't take much to be back in the midst of a gas crisis, would it?
Well, the thing about the reforms we've undertaken since coming to government and the provisions we've made in place is ensuring the Iona storage facility is up and running to a much better capacity than it was before. We also, I have quarterly meetings with the LNG producers, which enables me to review the supply situation as we go along. So if that small buffer is indicated because of some kind of other incident, like we saw with the wet coal in the mines and different problems with coal-fired generators on the East Coast the winter before last, we can work with industry to make sure that there are swaps of gas available to go into the system.
This winter, Queensland in many ways will come to the rescue because the southern states are facing a 25 petajoule shortfall over winter. Is that a sustainable situation in the longer term, or should Victoria, for example, reconsider its ban on onshore gas exploration?
Well, there's no doubt Queensland is doing the heavy lifting in terms of gas supply for the whole of the East Coast. Now, I'm not interested in criticising decisions of state governments. They make their choices. What I would say is that Queensland is doing the heavy lifting, but any gas you transport from long distances, like from far north Queensland in Gladstone, all the way down to Melbourne or the industrial estates of Victoria, it costs more money to get hold of that gas because you've got to move it through a pipeline, or if the import terminals end up eventuating, you've got to freeze the gas and defrost the gas and transport the gas.
And so that gets passed on to consumers and industry, right?
Well, absolutely, because costs always do with the production of any products, I suppose, and gas is no exception to that.
Madeleine King, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, David.
Madeleine King is the Federal Resources Minister. Since the COVID pandemic, working from home or hybrid work is now entrenched in many Australian workplaces. Now some companies are trying to entice workers back to the office by offering more annual leave to compensate for the commute. Bronwyn Herbert with this report.
Okay, bye, Baba.
Why you don't work at home today?
I'm going to the office.
Afsan Rastagari has a two-hour-plus return commute to work each day from her home in Sydney's southwest.
This station is Kingsbury.
But now an incentive offered by her employer, Stake, a city-based financial technology company, gives workers like her up to 7 days extra annual leave a year for coming into the office.
When I wake up, I kind of think, you know, maybe I do want to have that leave and bank it up in the future.
Stake's global head of people, Aline Van Coninsolo, says the flexible workplace conditions offered after the COVID pandemic were not effective.
Because it was different days for everyone, it didn't really enhance any collaboration. It didn't really feel like the office was full. So we created what we call offset days. Basically, time off that you accrue for each day that you come to the office.
A golf simulator is one of the work perks on offer by Brisbane-based cryptocurrency firm SwiftX. There's also an in-house barista and kombucha on tap. SwiftX's talent acquisition manager, Danielle Arabola, says it's about getting staff in the office for two anchor days a week.
Thinking about software engineers that sometimes are a little bit more introverted, we really put a lot of money and time into ensuring we had state-of-the-art chairs.
Professor Ray Cooper from the University of Sydney has led a national qualitative study which involved interviewing 500 people over the past 4 years, discussing what they want from the workplace.
Whether people work in the city or work in the outer suburbs or work regionally, whether they have kids or not, and whether they work in professional jobs or frontline jobs, that there is a very strong demand for flexible working, and as a part of that, a really strong demand for work from home.
The study found those flexible work opportunities are not evenly distributed.
Counterintuitively, we often think about flexibility as being a women's issue at work, if you like, but actually our research shows us that men have better access to flexible working arrangements. That reflects the structure of the labour market.
For workers like Afsan Rastagari, she's happy to trade the convenience and comforts of work from home to bank that extra leave.
I love a work-life balance. I think it's so important. So having that extra time off definitely helped.
That's Sydney worker Afsan Rastagari ending that report by Bronwyn Herbert. That's AM for today. Thank you for your company. I'm David Lipson.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. When something's in high demand, chances are a fake will enter the market. And that's what's happened with the weight loss drug Ozempic. Today, Four Corners reporter Elise Worthington on her investigation into the dodgy side of the wonder drug. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listener.